Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva today, Friday, the 19th of June. We have another very important and packed agenda for you. We'll start off immediately with our colleague Pascal, who will speak to the events taking place at the Human Rights Council, which, as you know, started off this past Monday. We also have announcements from our colleague James, who's joining us from Amman of UNICEF on Gaza. We also have a number of briefers on the situation in the DRC for Ebola, as well as a World Refugee Day announcement. But without further ado, Pascal, over to you.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. I just have two programming notes for you. The first one is that today at noon, the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Tlaleng Mofokeng, will hold a press conference in this room. This will be the last press conference of Ms. Mofokeng in her capacity as Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health. The second programming note is an anniversary. 20 years ago today, the United Nations Human Rights Council held its first session in the Palais des Nations in Geneva. And 20 years later, the current president of the council, Siddhartha Suryadipuro, is hosting an informal high-level discussion today to mark this anniversary. The discussion is entitled 20 Years, One Council, What We've Built and Where We Go Next. And this 20th anniversary offers an opportunity not only to reflect on what has been achieved over the past 20 years, but also to look ahead. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, will deliver a video statement, and we will have several panelists in an interactive discussion that will feature Ambassador Luis Alfonso de Alba, who was the first president of the Human Rights Council 20 years ago. The discussion is taking place today, starting at 12:30. It will last for about 2 hours in the Assembly Hall, the very same room where the Council held its first session 20 years ago. And the event will be webcast live on UN Web TV. Thank you.
Thank you. And I remember that while I was in the room 20 years ago. It'll be nice to see Ambassador de Alba as well. So, colleagues, any questions for Pascal before we move on? No, that's not the case. Well, good luck, and we'll see you this afternoon then. Thanks, Pascal. Okay, James, I see your face on the screen. Nice to see you, and looking forward to hearing your brief on the, well, actually, I shouldn't say that because it is a very, very difficult brief, but important nonetheless. So, deadly illusion of Gaza ceasefire. So, over to you, James, who's joining us from Amman. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Thank you.
Rollo, thank you. Good morning, everyone. For many, many months, the world has been told there is a ceasefire in Gaza. Yet for Palestinian children, this so-called ceasefire has become a cruel and a deadly illusion. Since the ceasefire was announced in October last year, 265 Palestinian children have been killed across Gaza. That is an absurd, that is a devastating figure. So during a period supposedly defined by restraint and protection, a child is killed on average every single day for more than 8 months. Now, let's be clear what that means. These children were not killed in a war zone. They were killed in their homes. They were killed in their schools. They were killed playing football. They were killed fishing. They were shot. They were bombed. They were struck by quadcopters. While the world continues to speak the language of ceasefire, families in Gaza continue to bury their children. However, if a child is being killed every day, surely the debate now is no longer about the quality of this ceasefire. It's about the credibility of calling it one. This week, a 2-year-old boy was shot and killed by Israeli forces. A 13-year-old boy was shot and killed in his tent. A 5-year-old boy and his father were killed by an Israeli strike. And on and on and on it goes. The suffering does not end with those killed. More than 400 girls and boys have been injured, many with catastrophic wounds. Again, this week, a 12-year-old girl in her tent shot in the chest with live ammunition from a crane-mounted gun. A 3-year-old girl, again, in her home, shot in the face by a bullet from a quadcopter drone. Doctors in Gaza are treating brain hemorrhages, devastating injuries to children's chests, abdomen, and life-changing trauma. Let me speak for a moment on trauma. For Gaza's children, fear, loss, and violence, they've become so constant that trauma is no longer an episode in their lives. It is woven into the very fabric of childhood in Gaza. It is quite literally carried in their bodies. The trauma is so profound now that it affects children's ability to eat, to sleep, and of course, to develop normally. Many children are in such a heightened state of fear, of distress, that they struggle now to eat adequately, further aggravating malnutrition and leaving them physically weaker as well as emotionally scarred. Sorry, colleagues. Hundreds of children still require medical evacuation. At the same time, we have restrictions on essential medicine that mean that wounded children are enduring ever greater pain and face an increased risk of infection, of complication, and of further amputations. We must stop accepting levels of child deaths that would provoke international outrage anywhere else. We must stop normalizing the abnormal. The fact that children continue to be killed at this scale during a ceasefire should alarm every government and every institution which claims to defend international law. The killing of children, it's not the consequence of a lack of options, it is the consequence of a lack of political will. Every day that passes without responsibility sends the same message. Palestinian children's lives can be taken without accountability. This is no longer a failure of the system. It has become the system. Ladies and gentlemen, if I could just add a final point on Lebanon, it is related. I want to flag to you a statement that UNICEF issued just 2 days ago on Friday on Lebanon, where after more than 100 days of increased hostility since the 2nd of March, 247 children have been killed, almost 1,000 injured. It's an average of 12 children killed or maimed every day, 12 girls and boys every day. The fact that we are once again calculating a daily average of children killed and wounded in the Middle East tells its own devastating story. And Lebanon, of course, we're also talking about periods of a declared ceasefire where children continue to be killed and wounded. No ceasefire can be considered meaningful when children are not protected. The violence against girls and boys in the Middle East must end. Rollo, colleagues, thank you.
Thank you, James. Absolutely. Couldn't say it better. It must end. And thank you for that sobering, very hard to hear, but important to hear. So let's take questions. Let's see if there are any in the room. I don't see any questions in the room. We have a question from Nick, New York Times Online. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, thank you, James. Thank you for the briefing. I just wonder if you could disaggregate a little bit on the causes of child deaths. In particular, you referred to a couple of cases of quadcopters inflicting serious injury on children. I mean, is this the main way in which child injuries and deaths are being caused at this stage, or are there other factors at play too?
Hi there, Nick. No, yeah, nearly all of those 265 children killed, nearly all of them are by Israeli forces. A handful by unexploded ordnance, even less by militia. But again, nearly all by Israeli forces, airstrikes, bombs, quadcopters. Part of this speaks to the continued movement of the yellow line and then the creation of an orange line to the west of the yellow line. As we know, the ceasefire agreement said 53% of Gaza would be held for a short period by Israeli forces. That's now closer to 60%. The most senior levels, they've said 70%. This is not open land. This is towns, entire communities, buildings, schools, clinics. We've got a clinic there that serves hundreds of people a day, a school that serves 4,000 people a day. Children had an evacuation order from there the other day. More than 60% of those people killed are somewhere near the orange line, still to the west, Nick, of the orange line, but you sneeze near the orange line and you may well get shot. So the continual creeping of that alongside an utter lack of accountability for a long, long time has meant, yes, this is why we have these numbers. And as I say, the vast, vast majority, 90% plus Israeli forces, bombs, airstrikes, quadcopters, and live ammunition.
Got that. Thank you, James. John Zarakostas. John.
Good morning, James. Thanks for the update. I was just wondering, UN liaison officers from UN OCHA, political, military, and also from UNICEF and other agencies, are you reaching out to the Israeli authorities? And what responses are you getting when you're presenting these hard facts to them?
John, we are in daily contact because, of course, our program is enormous. We lead on education. We lead on nutrition with World Food Program. We lead on water. We lead on sanitation. Probably worth adding at this point that we have more than an 80% funding gap. And so whilst we hear statements from Western governments around the world around the atrocities, not only do they not end them, at the same time they don't then fund the very care that Palestinians so desperately need. So we're in regular contact but of course, it's with the civilian arm of Israel, John, and you will hear statements from the highest levels of the Israeli governments about what their intentions are and about the justifications that are given. You know, John, we are very, very pleased. You know, I know you work a lot around nutrition in your role with The Lancet. We're very, very pleased there's no longer a famine. This is because food was allowed in. Let's be very, very clear on that. It is because we can now trace and treat under five children. We're very pleased with how the program is functioning. We are seeing what we think are emergency levels of malnutrition now in pregnant women and in children over the age of five because we don't have the necessary funds there. Remembering, I may be wrong, I would ask others. I don't know, UNICEF doesn't know of any other country on the planet apart from Israel that determines what another population eats and how much they get to eat. So whilst we have reversed some elements, they are at risk of collapsing in any particular moment, John. So yeah, we share these messaging all the time, both in terms of the grave violations that continue daily. So there is no accountability there. And we share them daily to try and get our supplies in to avoid children being sick as they are constantly because, you know, food, water, sanitation, again, the areas we lead on, and the great complexity in being able to repair these systems, not do stopgap measures.
Thanks, James. I'm going to go back to Nick, who I think you may have a follow-up. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, thank you, James. I just want to check, what are the particular medicines that are most acutely needed and are not being allowed in? And secondly, are you seeing an acceleration in evacuations of children and others who require medical treatment overseas? Thank you.
For the first, Nick, I'll come back to you and I'll add to anyone else on those. I'll get the exact list of essential medicines. Obviously, things change all the time. And we will be chastised for commenting on one particular item that may get entry that was previously blocked. So as ever, we are 100% precise and triple check all of our facts on this. But it's a nasty game, Nick, to give an example, we're pleased now that despite not being able to bring in the supplies to repair so many of the generators and water systems, those generators that can function, we are now getting the fuel we need in. At the same time, we're then denied the oil that those generators need to function. This is the environment my colleagues on the ground work in, keeping children breathing without a semblance of dignity. Sorry, Nick, your second question?
Yeah, maybe repeat that if you would, Nick.
Yeah, it was a question about medical evacuations, whether those are continuing at a regular pace or whether you're seeing an acceleration and a significant sort of downturn in the number of people waiting for essential medical care.
No, sadly, no. That West Bank corridor remains the game changer and remains denied. and those nations with the world-class hospitals in Europe, allowing for the Spanish and the Italians, continue to, by and large, close their hospital doors as well as their hearts. And not all, but as I say, a funding gap of more than 80% after an engineered famine, 21,000 children killed, not a single home has been built during the ceasefire. Families build barricades around their tents of sand to keep rats out. And we, as UNICEF, have more than an 80% funding gap. It speaks to a level of hypocrisy from those who have the leverage to actually stop this ongoing war on girls and boys in Gaza.
Absolutely. James, Jens has joined us here on the podium. We want to add a little context from the perspective of OCHA. Jens.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. To Nick's question, I just wanted to add a few points from the Emergency Relief Coordinator briefing at the Security Council yesterday on Gaza about the issues we are facing in this operation, which he described as being held together by humanitarian workarounds and Palestinian perseverance. So his asks, or demands, you might say, to the Security Council was, of course, to ensure the protection of civilians and of aid workers. You will recall that the past 3 years have been absolutely catastrophic for aid workers around the world. We have 1,000 killed, 600 of whom were in Gaza alone. That's staggering. So the protection. Secondly, to ensure safe, sustained, unhindered humanitarian access to everybody in need in Gaza. That is our blanket ask and has been for a very, very long time. And now we get into some more specifics. Immediate full capacity operations of the Erez crossing, Karni, and the Kerem Shalom to establish a high volume multi-route pipeline, plus access to very essential sites inside Gaza, in particularly the landfills near the perimeter. So there are landfills, and at the same time you have all this solid waste piling up inside Gaza. And we've all heard the stories about the rats, the insects, and so on and so forth that this causes. So there is an opportunity, there is a possibility to get rid of all that, but we are not getting the access to it. And then we need, and this is critical, I think, to the next question, the removal of Israeli restrictions on essential survival items, specifically medical equipment, including diagnostic tools, spare parts for water and sanitation, plus consistent supplies of fuel and engine oil, communication, and protective equipment for aid workers. We also need to get the staff in and to have them, to have the possibility of them moving in and out of Gaza. And here the problem is visas, which are issued by the Israeli authorities. So we ask for a restoration of humanitarian customs waivers and the issuance of long-term predictable, not month by month, long-term predictable visas for international UN and NGO staff, plus better, more streamlined NGO registration process. So thank you. I just wanted to add that.
Important additions. Thank you so much, Jens. Agnes.
Roland, do you mind if I make just one further point?
Yeah, please. Sorry. Go ahead, James, and then we'll take a question from AFP. But go ahead, James, please.
Thank you. It's about trying to imagine life in a ceasefire. Like when we talk about ceasefire, everyone tends to focus on negotiations. But UNICEF believes for a child, a ceasefire should be something much more simple than any of us and any of your audiences can imagine. It should mean for a child, they go to sleep through the night without fear. They wake to a meal. They walk to school. They learn. They play with friends. They come home. They do homework with the lights on. And they go to bed pretty much knowing tomorrow will be the same day. So it'll look the same. That's what childhood should look like. It's nothing like that in Gaza. There are still bombs. There are still children killed by quadcopters. Sanitation and health are shattered. No homes have been rebuilt. So when UNICEF thinks of what a ceasefire should look like, It's not complicated. You know, it's just the return of ordinary childhood, safety, stability, school, family, play. But instead, it looks and it sounds like hell. Rodents and other pests are across 80% of sites. More than half the households report skin diseases. I talk to mothers who have children screaming because they don't have the clean water to wash that. Imagine a parent unable to fix that night after night. I mean, the scale of human suffering in Gaza, being inflicted upon Gaza and enabled by others on Palestinian children, it's almost beyond comparison in our lifetime. So what is being done, and what is being allowed to be done to Palestinians in Gaza, feels like the worst of humanity, like the worst that we are capable of.
Thank you again, James. And yes.
Yes, thank you. As you mentioned the situation in Lebanon, I would like to ask you if it could be possible to have a comment from the UN or UN agencies on the situation of the fresh clashes and strikes overnight in South Lebanon. Thank you.
James, if you had any lines, and then maybe I could ask other colleagues, maybe Jens, if you had any lines on these fresh clashes.
Yeah, I think please do. I think that the final paragraph I added is exactly that, to speak to what's happened today, to speak to what's happened since the 2nd of March, and then a continuation of the day. So I don't think we have a lot more to add, but yeah, I'd love to hear from colleagues. Thanks, Rollo.
Let me just say what we've been saying here from this podium and as well as in New York and elsewhere. The SG, the Secretary General, remains deeply, deeply concerned by the ongoing tensions in the region and in the entire region of the Middle East, but you know, including in Lebanon. And he's calling on all parties, as always, to exercise maximum restraint and to avoid further escalation. I mean, this is something that we've been saying repeatedly. And it's important that these words translate into something meaningful. You've heard from James, you've heard from Jens, and this is absolutely essential. International humanitarian law and the protection of civilians must be upheld ultimately. So that's our comment generally, but I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add, Jens, or anyone else. Please go ahead.
No, just to say that we're seeing the same reports overnight, of course, with enormous concern, frankly. We will try to get a better handle on what the humanitarian implications of that has been. But more fighting is not going to help anyone, okay? We don't control who pulls the trigger. We can look at the consequences, the humanitarian consequences of what happens. And I think I've said it before, it is infinitely easier and faster to hurt people and inflict damage than it is to restore people's livelihoods, get them back to their homes, feed them, and so on and so forth. It's just one or two days of this kind of warfare that translate into months, sometimes years, of humanitarian operations on the ground.
Thank you so much. Okay, I think that does it. Just making a final check if there are any questions for either of you. I don't see that's the case. So, James, as always, thank you so very much for joining us and spotlighting this dire situation. And thank you, colleagues, for your reporting. And Jens, of course, thank you for joining us here. Okay, colleagues, we're going to move on to the situation of Ebola in DRC in particular. We have four guests. If I could ask our guests from the IOM, and maybe Eugene, if you want to join me on the podium as well, if you can come up now, I think, yes. And we have colleagues, as I mentioned, from the World Health Organization, UN Population Fund, UNHCR. We're going to connect with, are we actually in the room? Excuse me. Is somebody in the room? Yes, okay, you're in the room from UNHCR. And then we also have somebody from the IOM. So we're going to go immediately to our colleague who's joining us from Bunia in the DRC. And then we'll hear from our guests who are joining me here on the podium. So Dr. Marie-Rosalyn Belizer is WHO's Afro-Regional Emergency Director, again, an incident manager who, again, is joining us from Bunia. Dr. Belizer, we're very grateful to have you with us. So over to you for your brief.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for having me. So as you say, I'm speaking from Bunia, where I've been based for the last 6 weeks to support that outbreak. So in DRC, I can say the situation is evolving rapidly with accelerated transmission reported across 33 affected health zones in 3 provinces. So as of today, 19th of June, 2026, DRC has reported 896 confirmed cases and 232 confirmed deaths. So we have 21 new case confirmed cases recording in the last 24 hours. So we can also say that Ituri province remained the epicenter, accounting for more than 91% of the national burden of the outbreaks. So while we have North Kivu continues also to report cases, which is a critical high case of fatality in North Kivu. So when we see the disaggregated case fatality rate, we see that in Ituri, the case fatality rate is 20%, while in North Kivu is higher than 50%. So what have I seen? If I can share with you. So over the past several weeks, I have visited affected communities, treatment facilities, and operational hubs. I also what stand out most in the extraordinary commitment of the frontline responders. I also met with healthcare workers who are delivering care under difficult circumstances. They are also doing the surveillance, epidemiological surveillance, and the surveillance team is working tirelessly to investigate alert that has increased from 100 to now almost 400 alerts a day. And we also see a lot of community engagement team helping families to navigate fears and uncertainty. So I also met with people who survived Ebola. So far, we have more than 60 people that have been surviving Ebola and reunited with their families. We see also their recovery is a powerful reminder that a timely diagnosis, access to quality healthcare can save lives. So I also and heard directly from affected communities about the challenges they continue to face. We shouldn't forget that this outbreak is happening in a humanitarian situation already ongoing in the North Kivu and also in the Ituri province. And these concerns are helping to shape the response and priority. So what are we doing us as WHO? WHO, we are supporting the government in working alongside across all partners and all pillars of the response. So we have deployed more than 114 experts so far across 11 health zones and 3 provinces. So we also supporting the Ministry of Health to deploy 45 expert, national experts to strengthen outbreak coordination and response. So far, we have mobilized 31 million, which is only 28% of the resources that we are needed in order to support the government. And I also see increasing in capacity. You know, surveillance capacity is reinforcing with the deployment of 46 epidemiologists. We also see that more than 300 frontline healthcare workers were trained on how to on surveillance for Budingbujo virus in case definition and alert management. So far, we also see that an expansion of the response from zero. So we have now 516 beds available for the response and from a capacity of testing of 20 tests a day. So now we have more than 2,000 tests a day of capacity. And this can be also, in other aspects. That means the surveillance is increasing, but the challenge is still remaining. Because as you can see, the outbreak is evolving so fast that we also need them to scale up in order to be at the same level of the response. So key challenges that I want to share today is that, as I said, the outbreak evolves. And so we need operational requirement to continue to increase in order to reinforcing the need for sustained financing and support. We also have challenges with access. Sometimes it's very constrained when we need to go to some community due to insecurity in some high-risk area where we have cases. Contact tracing is improving. So now we have at 75% of contact tracing, but the target is 95%. So we still have challenges in order to increase that. Community death continue to be reported, which is a very big challenge for us, that indicate that some transmission chain are still occurring at the community level, and they are outside of the reach of some activities. In some community also, we have particularly those who are affected are displaced community. We have some cases registered in displaced population, which is very challenging because they are facing a lot of humanitarian needs, no water, no toilet, no access to, basic care. And then now they are affected by Ebola. So that means the need to expand the access to treatment, the need to expand the access to laboratory tests is also very critical for us. So overall, I can say that the outbreak remains serious and continue to evolve. But however, I have seen a response that is growing stronger every day. And we know that works to stop Ebola transmission. So our collective task is to continue applying those measures at the speed and scale required to bring this outbreak under control. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Bellizero. We're going to stay in country. We're going to move now to our colleague from the UN Population Fund, Noemi Del Monte, joining us from Kinshasa, if I'm not mistaken. You're the deputy country representative for UNFPA. Going to speak about the situation of women and girls in particular in the context of Ebola. So over to you, Noemi.
Good morning and thank you. This outbreak, we have just listened to WHO, but this outbreak is also a maternal health and protection emergency for women and girls. This outbreak is unfolding in an area already marked by conflict, displacement, insecurity, and overstretched health services, including as a consequence of the reducing funding. Women and girls in these communities already faced significant risk before that Ebola emerged. Now, this risk has intensified. Women are the primary carers for sick family members. Many frontline health workers, especially midwives and nurses, are women working in the maternity wards and health facilities where the risk of exposure is very, very real. At one health facility in Bunia, all reported Ebola infections were among frontline doctors and nurses, and four health workers died within a few days. Protecting health workers is central to keeping health services open. Previous outbreaks have shown alarming maternal mortality rates. Death rates among pregnant women infected with Ebola have been as high as 90%, and perinatal mortality is the period just before or after birth, has reached 100% in some settings. When Ebola spreads, also fear spreads with it. Pregnant women delay antenatal care. We are really seeing that daily in Ituri. They avoid health facilities or give birth at home, even when complications arise. So they can die not from Ebola itself, but because the care that would have saved them is not longer accessible, mostly is not longer trusted or not longer safe. We are already seeing the impact of this. The rate of maternal mortality in Ituri, the area which is the most affected by the Ebola outbreak, has doubled since 25 of May. This outbreak can trigger a second, quieter crisis of preventable maternal and newborn death. That is what UNFPA is working to prevent. UNFPA is part of the broader Ebola response. Our work focuses on pregnancy, childbirth, gender-based violence, and community trust. We are supporting infection prevention and control in maternity settings by training health workers, strengthening and washing and worst management system, and procuring personal protective equipment for high fluid delivery procedures, We currently have deployed 153 midwives in Eastern DRC to help maintain safe childbirths, emergency obstetric care, and postnatal care, with further deployments that we have planned, and also we are raising funds for that. We are also providing reproductive health kits, safe delivery supplies, dignity kits, and menstrual health kits, and other essential commodities. At the same time, we are scaling up the community outreach and information in women and girls' safe spaces, counter misinformation to combat stigma, who can particularly affect women and girls, and help pregnant women maintain trust in safe health services. Trust is essential. UNFPA's long-standing relationship with health workers, women groups, young people, survivors of violence, and local organizations help keep communities connected to accurate information and essential services when fear can push them away from the care they would need. There is also a serious protection dimension. Conflict, displacement, movement restriction, and the rapid scale-up of emergency personnel can increase risk for gender-based violence, but also for sexual exploitation and abuses. Services for survivors can also be disrupted when the clinical staff are reassigned elsewhere or when referral pathways break down and services reduce. UNFPA is strengthening prevention for sexual exploitation and abuses, supporting confidential reporting mechanism, and helping ensure survivors can still access medical care, psychosocial support, and all the needed referral services. Women and girls cannot be forgotten in this Ebola response. If maternity service break down, women will die. If health workers are not protected, services will collapse. If community lose trust, people will delay care or avoid health facilities. And if protection services are disrupted, survivors will be left without any support. In this context, UNFPA is appealing urgently for 17.1 USD million to sustain life-saving sexual reproductive health services, gender-based violence prevention and response, protection from sexual exploitation and abuses in particular, and risk communication and community engagement in the DRC affected areas. Today, the response remains more than 90% underfunded. This is essential for the continuity of essential services, which is a pillar of the current plan we have to fight against Ebola. The window for the prevention is now. Thank you for your kindness.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dalmonte. Now, very pleased to have with us on the podium Dr. Alan Mina, who is the Chief of Public Health at the UN Refugee Agency. And as you know, Eugene is here with us as well, but over to you, Doctor.
Thank you very much. And thank you to WHO and UNFPA for highlighting a good overview of the Ebola situation. And both speakers have highlighted the effect that it's having on the situation around displacement and conflict. UNHCR is deeply concerned by the accelerating spread of the Bundibugyo Ebola virus disease in Eastern DRC and the growing risk that it poses to refugees, internally displaced people, and the communities hosting them. We've already had the statistics of the number of cases and deaths, and we'd like to note that while we do not yet have any refugees reported among these cases, the risks remain high. The press statement will be shared, but I would like to highlight four key points in my statement. First, this outbreak is unfolding in the midst of a complex humanitarian crisis, cannot be overemphasized. More than 2 million forcibly displaced people, including over 320,000 refugees, live in at-risk areas in DRC, where active conflict alongside the spread of the Ebola disease is creating a lot of challenges in the response. Population movements driven by insecurity are creating additional challenges for the outbreak control. And I would like to add that earlier this month, over 2,000 people were reported to have moved from, displaced from Bao, a place called Bao, to Oicha in northern Kivu, following armed group movements. And this, in Oicha, we know that this is one of the Ebola-affected health zones, just demonstrating or illustrating how the conflict-driven displacement can increase exposure risks and why public health measures must be aligned with protection considerations. Second, community trust is essential to an effective response. For refugees and internally displaced people already facing trauma and insecurity and lack of adequate humanitarian assistance, the outbreak is fueling fear and misinformation. Earlier this month, response teams initially faced resistance in following Ebola-related deaths that were reported in a displacement site in Ituri, just 25 kilometers from Bunia. Such incidents demonstrate that outbreak control depends not only on the medical interventions, but also a meaningful engagement with communities, local leaders, and trusted networks. UNHCR is supporting government-led efforts to strengthen that engagement. In the past week in Bunia, more than 100 community and site leaders were trained on Ebola prevention and risk communication so they can share the information in the local languages and trusted formats. Further sessions are planned for more remote sites, and as well in Ituri along the southern Sudan border, trained refugees have been helping install chlorinated hand washing stations in refugee hosting villages. My third point is that solidarity and international support for government-led response efforts are critical. The authorities in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and Uganda are leading a complex response under extremely challenging circumstances. They are supported by WHO, Africa CDC, and UN partners and other humanitarian partners, and the local communities working to contain the outbreak and protect affected populations. As the case numbers continue to rise, sustained international solidarity and scaled up support are essential. And the response must keep pace with the outbreak and remain firmly anchored in national leadership. My fourth point is that the response must be inclusive and protection-centered. The risk is regional. Eastern DRC sits in an interconnected region where trade, family ties, and refugee movements link Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, and South Sudan. UNHCR is working with governments and partners to strengthen preparedness, surveillance, infection prevention, risk communication, and water sanitation hygiene support in refugee hosting areas and border corridors. We aim to prevent further cross-border transmission without impeding people seeking safety. Governments must continue to lead the response and have a responsibility, and they have a responsibility to protect public health. However, UNHCR believes that border closures are not necessary and indeed are ineffective at preventing the spread of the epidemic, as they can drive people towards unofficial crossing points where health screening and surveillance are more difficult. Public health measures should preserve access to asylum for people in need of international protection with appropriate public health measures. I'd like to conclude by saying that UNHCR and partners are working with local authorities hand in hand to strengthen community-led preventive measures, and we're working to ensure displaced communities are included in national health responses and protected from blame or discrimination, with particular attention to women and girls, as UNFP has rightly highlighted. Given the rapid increase in cases, the response must scale up accordingly and remain firmly anchored in national leadership. And it must not come at the expense of other essential services like primary health care, including maternal and child health, nutrition, mental health, and psychosocial support, as well as services for survivors of gender-based violence and education. UNHCR is therefore appealing for $14 million to support Ebola preparedness and response efforts through November 2026 in the DRC and Uganda, and strengthen preparedness in Burundi, Rwanda, and South Sudan. Containing this outbreak will require solidarity, scaled up and sustained investment, and a response that reaches everyone at risk without discrimination. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mano. We'll now move to our last briefers. We have Kit Lung, and sorry we got the name mixed up in the agenda, but it's Kit Lung, who's Senior Migration Health Advisor at the International Organization for Migration. Zoe, I is going to maybe read out the statement first, and then Kit is available, or Ms. Lung is available for responses to your question. So over to you, Zoe.
Thank you very much. So I am briefing for IOM today on how we have now conducted over 1 million health screenings and are scaling up our Ebola response. And I have Kit with me to answer questions afterwards. The Ebola outbreak in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is unfolding across one of the most active cross-border movement corridors in Africa, where thousands of people move every day in search of work, safety, healthcare and connection with their families. That reality presents both a challenge and an opportunity. Understanding human mobility patterns is one of our strongest tools for stopping disease spread, if we understand where people are moving, why they are moving, and how to reach them with timely health interventions. IOM has now surpassed 1 million health screenings at borders and along key cross-border routes and travel corridors across affected and at-risk countries. This includes support at over 110 points of entry. This figure is significant not only because of its scale, but because it reflects the enormous effort required to stay ahead of a disease. In Ituri province alone, more than 16,000 people cross porous borders every day. Across the wider region, countless others travel along routes that connect communities, markets, health facilities, and displacement sites. These movements are essential to daily life. They will not simply stop. Our responsibility is therefore to ensure that life-saving health measures move with people. This is a challenging response. As part of the Africa Centre for Disease Control coordinated effort to respond to the outbreak, we are collectively still not ahead of the Ebola virus. Like our sister agencies, we are experiencing issues such as border closures, pushing people to less observed crossings, community mistrust, security, including an attack on one of our teams, and availability of personal protective equipment, PPE. As the outbreak has spread across North Kivu, South Kivu, and Ituri provinces with confirmed transmission into Uganda, IOM has intensified its response. We today announce a scale-up of our operation in DRC and Uganda. Against a backdrop of insecurity and population displacement, we are strengthening health surveillance at border crossings and other strategic points along mobility routes. We are deploying additional personnel to high-risk areas. We're expanding mobility mapping and analysis to help governments and partners identify where they need to areas of greatest concern and direct resources where they are needed most. At the same time, preparedness measures are being reinforced across neighbouring countries, recognising that disease containment requires regional action and regional solidarity. What is at stake extends beyond the current outbreak. This is about protecting communities, preserving trust, and strengthening the systems that help countries detect, prevent, and respond to future health threats. The progress made shows what is possible when governments, communities, and partners work together, but sustaining that progress requires continued investment. Additional support is urgently needed to maintain surveillance, strengthen cross-border preparedness, protect vulnerable populations, and prevent further transmission. The faster we act, the greater our chances of containing this outbreak and safeguarding the health and well-being of communities across the region. And just to say, the expanded data can be found in our SITREP number 5 being released today, and our Deputy Director General, Ugochi Daniels, will attend the Tuesday briefing next week to talk further about our operations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Zoe and Kit, for being here. So we have a lot of expertise. Before we just go to questions, let me just mention one thing which we did announce yesterday, but I wanted to make sure you're aware. It's actually with sadness that we know one of our colleagues, subcontractor working for our UN peacekeeping operation in the DRC in MONUSCO, which, as you know, is providing critical logistical assistance to enable the rapid delivery of medical services. He passed away. A subcontractor worker working with MONUSCO passed away from Ebola. He was recruited in Bunia. I don't have more details, but I just wanted to make sure you're aware that even, you know, our frontline workers are obviously facing great risks. So on that note, let's take questions, starting with Agnes in the room, and then we have one online as well, Agnes AFP. And if you could kindly just point your question to whoever you want.
Yes. So, I have a question to IOM and a question to WHO. So first to IOM in the room. You are talking about health screening. I would like to ask you if you could specify what kind of health screening you are talking about. Are you doing tests to see if they have Ebola, or what other kind of screening you are doing? And then the question to WHO. Concerning the spread of the virus, could you tell us where it's happening now? I'm not talking about the region, but where is it, in homes, in hospitals, in the battlegrounds? If you could elaborate on that. And then a specific question on the lethality in North Kivu. I've seen on the national report of the Institut National de Santé Publique de RDC that the lethality in North Kivu is around 60%, while it's around 20% in Ituri and 30% in South Kivu. So how do you explain that it's so much higher in North Kivu? What is happening there? Thank you.
Thanks, Kit. We'll start off with Kit from IOM, and then we'll go to our colleague in Bunia.
Sure. Thank you so much, Agnes, for the question. So on screening, and rightly pointed out, as Zoe said, we have established over 110 points of entry in terms of screening, and it's based on syndromic screening. So these are protocols that are developed together with the surveillance pillars and working groups within the countries where we're operating, not just in DRC, also in Uganda, Burundi, South Sudan, Rwanda, and a number of other countries that look at identifying alerts that then go into a longer referral process for verification with the surveillance team. So the role of the surveillance officers, frontline workers at the points of entry, but also at these points, and in DRC, I note we've also supported local authorities to establish over 40 points of surveillance and screening, which are positioned along major routes, transport routes, trade routes, and any passages where we see a large movement of people to be able to detect the first signs of potential infection. Thanks.
Thank you, Kit. Dr. Belizaire? Oh, sorry, did you want to follow up on that before
yes,
we go?
Please. Okay. Yes, so concretely it means that it's just like looking how the people are, how they feel, and if you see any symptoms, then they do tests?
Correct. So based on observation, based on self-report, we look at travel history. And as mentioned, we have WHO on the line as well. Those teams are then linked to surveillance teams that if there is an alert, they are quickly identified, isolated, and they go for further testing. Thanks.
Yes, Dr. Belizaire, on the second questions, I should say.
Okay, thank you for the question. So effectively, as you mentioned, the case fatality rate is different in the Ituri province than the North Kivu province. So one of the reasons that we are seeing that differences is because those going onto North Kivu are from Ituri when they are seeking care. That means they are already sick and they have to move from Ituri in order to go to North Kivu for looking for care in Beni. The first cluster of cases that we have in Beni was a family of four people who came from Ituri, from Bunia, and they have to go all the way the time they were six, and the kid died in Beni. So this is one of the reasons. The second one is that now that the epidemic has been well installed in Beni or in North Kivu, we still have people not seeking care early. You know, they are staying at home because, as I mentioned, the symptoms are not really hemorrhagic symptoms. 90% of the cases that we are having in this outbreak, they don't have hemorrhagic symptoms. So a affected community, they stay at home taking auto-medication, and also they are going to traditional healers before coming to healthcare centers. So that means there's a delay in the access to healthcare. So one of the reasons that we are having this highest case fatality rate in North Kivu. So now when we look at where is the outbreak is a community outbreak now. So that means it's expanded at the community level. Reason why we are having a community death, but what is also the good point in it is that the surveillance is now able to detect those mortality at community level. So we can provide safe and dignified burial to those deaths in the community in order to protect people or to protect family members, not to manipulate those body. Because the Ebola body, a dead body with Ebola, is more infectious when the body is still alive. So it's a very high risk when the community is manipulating the dead body. So this is what we are doing in order to protect those community in manipulating it. Over.
Okay, thank you very much, Doctor. I will take a question now from Emma Farge, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. A question for WHO and maybe UNFPA. Can you talk more about healthcare workers? Do you have new data for how many have been infected or have died from the virus? And could you say something about how they're coping with this? Are any of them walking out? What happens if there's not enough carers in that hospital to care for them? Naomi, you mentioned a place where all healthcare workers were sick with Ebola. So tell me more about what they're going through. And another one for WHO, please. You mentioned that people aren't going to healthcare centers. Are you concerned about setbacks for other diseases like malaria or maybe others? And finally, for IOM, are you seeing any resistance at these healthcare screening points? You mentioned attack on your team. Can you tell us more? Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. Okay, maybe we'll start with Noemi, and then we'll go to you, Dr. Bellizera, on the two questions. Noemi, are you with?
Yes. Okay, thank you. The thing about how people are coming. So this question is, we are observing various behavior in the community. Dr. Belisa just talked about the fact that the epidemics is a lot at community level. And we know that women, for instance, are the one who take care of the ill people and so on. And as the symptoms are not the Zaire usual one, it takes maybe more time to detect them. And we also have community resistance. We are working a lot on the community resistance. There is a group working on the information with the community and to understand how they are perceiving the virus and the disease and the role the virus is playing in the community, and to fight a little bit on the negative social norm that are not making people believe that is a serious illness and so on. So we are working with this part to try to increase the referral, increase the trust to go to the health service. And on the other part of the question on how the health workers are coping with the disease, that I think that this question is better for WHO. What I can say is that for the maternity wards and for the work we are supporting in the maternity, we also have some psychosocial support that we provide, and we are trying to reduce, like, have a lot of turnover among the midwife so they can rest, because the procedure to put on all the protective equipment is like, it might be stressful because you need really to pay attention to all the process in putting on and working on that. The other important thing that the health worker who died, it was a lot, is still happening, but it was really a lot at the beginning of the epidemics where we didn't know that Ebola was there. So a lot of people got contaminated at the very first stage of the epidemics. And I'm sure WHO can add a lot on this.
Thank you, Noemi. Yes, over to you, Dr. Bellizera.
Okay, so thank you so much. They are very important question, you know? So it's really heartfelt when you see healthcare workers dying the time that they are providing care. So as my colleagues from UNFPA mentioned, at the starting of the outbreak, healthcare workers were the first to be infected. And actually, I met with the fourth we were surviving from this outbreak. And when they are explaining to you how they live it, how they were infected, it's really, you can break your heart. So far, as the data I have on my hand, so we have more than 60, healthcare workers who have been affected by Ebola, and 34 deaths amongst the healthcare workers. So it is a really high price that the healthcare system is paying, because we don't have enough of healthcare workers in our DRC. It is one of the big problems in the health system they have. And on top of that, we are losing them because of some of infections that they contracted while doing their work. So how they are coping with it? I can say so. So we have some who are very well trained, okay, and those who have been infected, we see their commitment to return to work. It has been really, I can say, very impressive to see how they want to continue their work. And we also have another group who have some, for example, I was in a hospital yesterday. We have three medical doctors, one still working and two have stopped because they fear for their life. So we are supporting them with psychological support, but also with more training, because it's a question of having, I can say, of trust themselves that they are able to do the job. And we are also protecting them by providing protective equipment. The protective equipment is not only distributed in the Ebola treatment centers, they are distributed in other healthcare centers. Although they are not the same level of protective equipment, but we see in this place where healthcare workers were touching everybody with their hand without gloves. So this is what we are doing. So how do we do it? So we evaluate all the healthcare centers that we have in E2E. I can give you an example. Over 177 healthcare centers that we have evaluated, only 4 have the capacity to prevent infection prevention disease in their infrastructure. So all the others, so we have to now put them at the level and also provide the healthcare worker the training they need, but also the material they need to work, hand washing station, gloves, and also a light PPE in those healthcare center. So what the other question was about, I think I replied to the question about how many have died. I give the number, do we have, because this number can change tomorrow. And we also how they are coping. I also respond to that. So we say concern about the disease, other disease. Absolutely. So as I mentioned, when I was doing my, opening remark, Ebola is happening in a situation that already exists. Malaria is still one of the biggest health concerns in this region, you know? And we also have other disease, and the continuity of services is an integrated pillar of the response. The response has 11 pillars, and one of them is continuity of services. That is, it's very important that women can continue to deliver safely, that children continue to have their vaccination, so that we don't create another health problem while responding to Ebola. For all patients, they are also testing for Ebola. For malaria. All when we have a suspected case, the first test that we do is a rapid test for malaria. And even though we do the rapid test for malaria, we also do a test for Ebola because the symptoms are just the same. They are similar to malaria. And it is also one of the reasons why the patient are staying at home doing auto-medication, because the bleeding is not seeing only 10% of the cases that we are seeing the bleeding and the hemorrhagic symptoms. All the other symptoms are similar to fever, muscle aches, headache, vomiting, diarrhea. So exactly. So it is really the same. And we do also the test. And when the patient are also hospitalized in an ETU, we also conducted biochemistry tests. We also tested their kidney. We also tested their hepatic tests in order when they are receiving the medication that we are giving, so we make sure that we don't cause more damage in those patients. So it's really in holistic care, and this care, we really make sure that it is a dignified care that we are doing. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so very much. Last question was to you, Kit.
Sure. And on the security incident, so yes, I can report on the 13th of June, IOM teams were involved in a security incident when traveling from one of these internal screening points in Bongwali Health Zone together with local health authorities. They were approached by community members who were leaving a funeral. I can report all staff members and partners are safe, but we did sustain damage to a vehicle. And this re-emphasizes the importance of trust and communication with communities, particularly as we continue to strengthen screening and surveillance activities at borders and along major mobility corridors. So to the question, yes, risk communication remains critical as part of the package in these certain sites, both for the travellers, so why we screen, the importance of screening, what happens if you are identified for further screening, but also with the surrounding communities. And these are communities that engage regularly with travellers, and we note also in the area amongst displaced populations, traders, but also mine workers who are frequently moving between certain sites within the population. So extending that risk communication as it is with all pillars of the response is extremely critical, particularly as it regards to movements of people. Again, for IOM, the focus is very much focused on ensuring that all movements are safe and visible, so that we're able to ensure that public health actions are really tailored and targeted towards population mobility movements. Thanks.
To you, and I think Dr. Minor wanted to add something on the other diseases. Yep.
No, sorry, excuse me. Thank you very much, and I really appreciate that question on other diseases. As I mentioned also in my statement, it is very important, and we see, and I first start by acknowledging that the local partners and all other partners supporting the response, including in the humanitarian settings, are working under extremely difficult circumstances, noting that the response was already severely underfunded. So a lot of these healthcare workers, the partners, are working under difficult conditions just to ensure that we respond not only to Ebola, but also in ensuring continuity of other essential services. And as Dr. Belize has already explained, malaria is a concern, and we see malaria as among the top diseases that has been reported among the refugees and displaced populations. We also seen other outbreaks. We've had recent outbreaks of cholera as well in these locations. And amidst all that, we have children also who are malnourished, and the mothers need to make sure that they can be able to receive treatment that they need. So it is a complex response, and we need to ensure that not only the support for the Ebola response, but also continuity of other essential services. Thanks.
And of course, compounding this is the insecurity in the region, which has been prevailing for quite a while. So it's a very complex setting. But thank you very much for those responses. We'll have one more question before we wrap up. John Zarakostas of The Lancet.
Yes, good morning. My question is to the WHO representative from the field. If you could repeat the number of health personnel that were infected and have passed away, and if you can clarify how many of these infections happen in health facilities or outside health facilities. And secondly, if you have any figures, if you're getting international medical teams coming in to assist with some of the field hospitals, or if there are problems. And in past Ebola outbreaks in West Africa, I remember there was a big medical corps from Cuba. Are they coming as well, or due to the financial constraints, they're not being deployed? Thank you.
Dr. Belizer.
Yes, thank you. So actually, it was something I wanted to give because I have the exact data on how many healthcare workers has been infected. So far, we have 75, the data of today. We have 75 healthcare workers who have been infected from the Ebola Butimbujo. And among them, we have 17 deaths who have been, this is a 20.46% of those who have been infected die of the disease. So now where the infection has occurred, it will be, I can say, very tricky to say because we have a community outbreak, you know, so which is very different of the outbreak in Uganda, for example. In Uganda, they have, I think, four healthcare workers who has been affected. We are sure they are affected in health facility while they are treating the patients. But in DRC, as we are seeing a community, large community outbreak, we cannot say for sure they have been infected in healthcare, in a health facility, or they have been infected in their community. So, you know, so, but however, this is some investigation that we should continue to do. And this is the reason why that we are providing training, providing PPEs, and providing also psychological support to the healthcare workers in order to support them. So regarding international medical team, so there is a Chinese medical team who arrive in DRC. We also have Uganda who will deploy a team, but mostly in the border as a cross-border response together with DRC. It will be, I think, in Aru. Aru is sharing the border with Arua. So we were there last week. And DRC is sharing eight health zone with Uganda. So this collaboration of cross-border will be extended in four health zones across the border that has been, infected. As you know, the outbreak in Uganda, among the 19 cases they have, 14 have been imported from a DRC. And the other five they have are also infected in Uganda. One is a driver who also support one of the cases from DRC to move from the border to the health center. And four others are healthcare workers who take care of those patients from DRC. So regarding Cuba, we don't have this information yet. So maybe this is something that if we have it, we can come back to you to give you the information. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. Well noted. Emma, that's a new hand. Yeah, go ahead. Back to you.
New hand. Because I was interested in what she just mentioned.
Sure.
How big is the China team? And are they the first foreign doctors, please? Thank you.
Back to you, Marie. Yep.
So thank you. Yeah. So for the Chinese team, I didn't meet them yet. I know they arrived in Kinshasa, but they are not yet in Bunia, where I am now. So we are waiting to see what is the composition of the team, what they can, where they will be sitting, setting, and all that. So far, we don't have more information on that, knowing that the Chinese team has arrived in Kinshasa. Maybe for Uganda, I have more information. This collaboration, for example, will be in critical pillar. This collaboration will be in case management, coordination, laboratory, and surveillance. So those pillars in Aru health zone in the border, they will be co-leading by both countries, DRC and Uganda. And Uganda will deploy a team of 40, team members that will be deployed across all those pillars.
Well noted. Thank you so much. Thank you to all of our briefers here. It was excellent and very vital brief. So I'd like to thank you, Marie, Noemi, Alan, and Kit for joining us at this press briefing. And thanks again for your reporting, colleagues. So thanks. Eugene, if you could stay with me, I think you have an announcement. Tomorrow is an important day. We just heard from Dr. Mina about the plight of displaced persons and, of course, the refugees as well. But we have an important observance tomorrow, World Refugee Day. So I think Eugene wanted to announce something to that regard. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So as Rolando just mentioned, that tomorrow we mark World Refugee Day as every year on 20th June. This is a moment to stand with the refugees and the people forced to flee, honor their courage, recognize the community that welcomed them, and remind the world that protection saves lives. As ever, this will be marked by events, large and small, across the world, from Buenos Aires to Bangkok. As you will have seen already from our press release this week, UNHCR launched our initiative Until Everyone Is Safe to mark the World Refugee Day. This initiative tried to position refugee protection not as a legal or distant issue, but as a collective safety net that exists for everyone. And I'm so glad to see a lot of the younger generation present today, because this initiative call specifically the younger generation to join this initiative and a voice to defend the very fundamental human right, and then human right, which is the right to seek safety. This year, the World Refugee Day coincides with the 75th anniversary of the 1519 Refugee Convention, a unique moment to remind the world why the right to seek safety was created, which was actually established and created after the Second World War, and why it still matters after 75 years later. With the forced displacement around the record highs at the moment, mounting pressure on asylum system, and a shrinking humanitarian funding, there has never been a more important time to reaffirm this fundamental right. Until everyone's safe, we are aiming to shift the narrative from crisis fatigue to collective responsibility, underscoring that international protection frameworks exist not only for refugee or for some vulnerable community, but for all of us. The initiative will run through key moments, including the 75th anniversary of the convention, Refugee Convention, signing on 28th of July, and the UNHCR Nansen Refugee Award, continuing through the Global Refugee Forum in 2027. You heard last week from our High Commissioner Bahram Salih, who outlined a 50 by 35 dignity and solution initiative, an aim to have the number of refugees in protracted displacement reliant on humanitarian assistance by 2035. The High Commissioner is currently in Ethiopia, where he has been working with the government to launch the Makhatet Roadmap, a nationally owned framework to include refugee into public system and services across health, education, livelihood, and infrastructure. He's also commending Ethiopia's long-standing solidarity in hosting people forced to flee despite the significant challenges of its own. Hosting over 1.1 million refugees and asylum seekers, Ethiopia is one of the Africa's largest refugee hosting country, and we urge it to continue doing so. Ethiopia continues to offer refuge to people fleeing conflict and extreme weather condition across the region. More than 45,000 Sudanese refugees have arrived, mainly in the Beni Shagul Gurmuz region, since the Sudan war began in 2023 April. 1,000 more from South Sudan have recently arrived in Gambela region, seeking protection as violence escalates in eastern Jonglei state in South Sudan. So to conclude, this year, solidarity is more important than ever. The right to seek asylum is under growing pressure in many parts of the world. 75 years after the 1951 Refugee Convention, we must keep its promise alive, that people fleeing war, violence, and persecution can find safety and asylum and protection. On World Refugee Day, UNHCR called on all of us to defend that lifeline and keep the promise of safety alive. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Eugene. And for his part, to mark this important day, World Refugee Day, the Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who knows the subject intimately as the former High Commissioner for Refugees, did issue a message which we shared with you. Among other things, the Secretary General calls for stronger support for all the refugees, including the countries we just heard from, the millions of women and children around the world who seek safety far from their homes. So he's seeking stronger support for their plight, as well as the countries and communities hosting them, as we just heard as well. So do take a look at that message which we shared with you in multiple languages. Do we have any questions for Eugene? No? Okay, well, thank you very much again for this important announcement. I have just a couple more before we wrap up. Simply, I wanted to make sure that you saw the message. It's a statement that we shared with you last night on behalf of, attributable to the spokesperson for the Secretary General on the situation in Sudan, particularly in El Obeid. In North Kordofan State, the Secretary General is deeply concerned by the escalation of the fighting in and around El Obeid in North Kordofan State, including drone attacks impacting civilians and civilian infrastructure. He is particularly alarmed by reports of the deployment by the Rapid Support Forces of substantial military reinforcements around El Obeid, which may indicate an imminent ground offensive on the city. potentially placing yet another major population center in Sudan at grave risk of large-scale violence. The Secretary General calls for restraint from all parties and urges them to take all necessary measures to respect and protect civilians. The statement goes on, but I wanted just to repeat some of these important messages. I should also note that the High Commissioner for Human Rights also issued a statement on the situation in El Obeid yesterday. In terms of some planning, the Secretary General will be in London next week to attend a very important event. It's actually Climate Action Week, and the Secretary General will be delivering an important remark, or important statement, I should say, at 10 a.m. Geneva time on Tuesday, the 23rd, at London Climate Action Week. Now, this special address, the remarks will outline how renewable energy offers the clearest route to energy security, affordability, and resilience. So climate and energy crisis during the Climate Action Week on the 23rd of June. It will be webcast, and we'll also share the comments with you as soon as they become available. Another observance for you, in addition to World Refugee Day, today is actually the International Day for the Elimination of Sexual Violence in Conflict. The Secretary General issued a message on this day as well, among other things. This year's observance focuses on children subjected to this deplorable crime. And the Secretary General, among other things, he calls for the end to this abomination, requiring protection, accountability, and prevention. Children must never be targets in war. Protecting them is legal and moral imperative for every combatant in every country, the Secretary General says. Reminder for you, colleagues, you've seen the media advisory we shared with you, I think it was last week, concerning the global dialogue on AI governance taking place here in Geneva at PALEXPO on 6 and 7 July. This is ahead of the AI for Good and the WISIS conferences all taking place jointly at this venue. You should register if you're, you must register if you're interested in attending. Your badge it's a fast-track approach for those of you with the UNOG badges, but you must register on the system. Do take a look at the media advisory if you need help. Ask myself or Francois, and we'll help guide you. And as you heard from Pascal earlier, we do have a press conference in exactly 37 minutes from now. In this seat will be the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health, Tlaleng Mofokeng, who's will be delivering her last remarks here as she's about to depart from this important job. So, any questions? No. So I wish you a good afternoon, good weekend. See you here on Tuesday. Thanks.